Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Jensies from Kent State University, and this week's topic is working with the gifted child. And our guest is Dr. Jean Peterson of Purdue University. She's being interviewed by Nona Wilson of St. Cloud State University.
Hello, this is Nona Wilson from St. Cloud State University in Minnesota, and I'm here in Kansas City at the North Central ACES Convention with Dr. Jean Peterson from Purdue University. And I've had the pleasure of seeing Dr. Peterson present on her work, giving her school counseling students an opportunity to do some direct group work in schools. Hello, Jean.
Hello.
I am really glad to have the opportunity to interview you. And to get us started, I would like to just say a little bit about your background. I think for many of the listeners, they might best know your work with John Luttrell in writing Portrait and Model of a School Counselor. They might also know you from your work for a couple of books, Talking to Teens. And I'm aware that you also have just published with Saul Mandeglio the text Models of Counseling Gifted Children, Adolescents, and Young Adults. And really, Dr. Peterson has spent the last 20 years of her professional life interested in the social and emotional development of gifted children. And Jean, your work in that area is just incredible. You have done, I think it's close to 200 presentations over the years, and you've written numerous articles, book chapters, you've gotten lots of awards, you do trainings. It's really pretty impressive, and I'm excited to talk to you about that work. I wonder if we could start by having you say just a little bit about what got you interested.
Sure, be happy to. It's it kind of was gradual. I was a K-12 teacher for many years, and the 19 years that I spent as an English teacher, I was dealing with some very bright people, and I think I began to be fascinated particularly with gifted underachievers, many of whom were my best writers. They certainly were thinking outside the box in many cases, and were complicated kids. So that was one thing, and I think by the time that I eventually spent 5 years directing a gifted program at a high school, a large high school, it made sense to me that I should have as one component out of 25 in the gifted program, that one component would be discussion groups for talking about development, not about academics and not about performance, but about growing up. And in the end, I suppose I dealt with about 500 kids that way because we did have about 115 kids a year, a week, coming in for two-hour-long group sessions a day, every week, year-long, and the same kids would stick with it for three years, basically, and we never ran out of topics. And these were semi-structured discussions, all on a topic that dealt with growing up. So they were proactive. They were, you know, in the prevention mode, and this was before I knew what I was doing, basically, and I realize now in retrospect that I was, and nobody was doing that kind of thing in gifted education at that time, for sure, and that's when I started speaking about it, and then that eventually led me into counseling degrees, because I thought I needed a little more credibility, and I sort of got hooked, and so this became my research agenda, at least part of it. I suppose the umbrella would be, the big umbrella for my research would be dealing with special populations and helping school counselors be prepared to deal with special populations of a wide variety of them. But about 60-70% of my work has been exploring, I suppose you could have to say I'm an explorer, I do qualitative work mostly, the inner world of gifted kids, beyond the stereotype. I'm interested in the, many times I think that gifted kids in general, or kids with high ability, that they are seen kind of one-dimensionally. They are seen, you know, by what, by their grades, by their performance, by their talent development, etc. And that the kids themselves told me repeatedly in these groups that they just felt that they were seen as robots, that nobody cared about anything other than their achievement or non-achievement. And purposefully, I went after underachievers because I figure there may even be a greater need for them to be affirmed in programs in the schools than for the kids who have a pretty good fit with the curriculum and the whole school milieu, the competitive environment, the fact that they are, you know, to the ideal being the motivated child who does perform. So going way back to my English teaching, that fascination with the kids that don't quite fit this, don't fit the stereotype, who cannot or will not, for a number of reasons, any number of reasons, perform. So the idea that gifted kids often are seen sort of one-dimensionally, I figure that my interest and my mission, in a sense, is to explore that inner world, find out what are they really like, what are their struggles, what should we, what are we not seeing, and then also to expand who we look at, because a lot of the research in the past has looked at kids who were conveniently able to be sampled, summer residential programs for gifted kids, or kids in AP classes, or kids in residential facilities, schools for gifted kids. Those are convenient samples, and they tend to be not very inclusive, probably in general. And I contend that we probably, maybe, actually some other people have said this in the field, we may be missing 50% of the kids. Kids who, you know, don't have good English facilities, so that they can't be verbally assertive, which is one of the checklists, or one of the, you know, verbally adept. My own research has shown that dominant culture teachers tend to look at classroom behavior and work ethic, quote unquote, depending on how you look at that, work ethic, behavior, family status, verbal assertiveness and verbal ability, and social skills as kind of the big things. And when they talk about gifted kids, that's what they're talking about when they justify recommending them for a program and so forth. And that really leaves out a ton of kids. So I'm concerned about the kids that we don't think about and that aren't identified and therefore are not studied. So I'm really bent on studying the kids that may not be identified and may not be part of the picture for most people, and kind of exploring then in general, even with those kids that are the stereotype, kids, the high achievers, what about their burdens? What about their struggles that may be related to their high ability?
Well, I think you have a very interesting perspective about this because you had worked for, I think, almost 30 years as a teacher.
19 years as a teacher and then 5 years in gifted education.
Okay. So 24 years mm-hmm. In the classroom and started noticing the needs of these kids. And then that turned into this area of scholarship for you as a counselor educator. And I think sometimes we're not always sort of tapped into the needs of that population. There's a lot of concern about looking at the needs of special populations. Mm-hmm. I don't know that gifted children have been a focus of that. So
it's kind of a cliche in the field, actually, that I remember hearing this early on, that it's very hard to parade gifted kids in front of the legislature to say, look at these poor kids. You know, that doesn't generate a lot of sympathy or support or concern about needs. And, you know, basically that is what I'm focusing on, is the needs, figuring out what they are and then figuring out what we should do about them.
And being an advocate for them. And so I wonder if you could just spend a little bit of time talking about what it is that you think school counselors in training need to know about this population.
Well, one way that I approach it is to look at, we don't have a lot of empirical evidence about these needs in a way. We do, you know, from these maybe non-inclusive populations, we can say that yes, we know that they, and this is important for school counselors, that gifted kids are worrying and being concerned about career at very young ages. They are already imagining themselves in the future, at least the kids that are coming from enriched backgrounds for whom that is, you know, something that, that is part of their life, people talking about the future and thinking about the future. I work a lot with at-risk kids in general, and I know that it's very difficult for some kids to imagine anything in the future. But as far as the kids that maybe we're thinking about here in general, the stereotype particularly, they really are precociously involved with that, sometimes with pretty high anxiety. And one aspect of that, everybody doesn't agree that multiple potentiality exists, but the idea that kids are maybe good at many things, certainly at young ages where they haven't winnowed down yet, that can create anxiety, the fact that they can't imagine maybe not doing something or doing something and choosing. Just the same way in the end, they might be quite anxious about choosing the right perfect college and the right major and the right spouse or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, when you're able intellectually to control a lot, those kinds of things that are not so certain can, you know, be, they can produce some anxiety. So with that, then, I'd like to say that the literature does say, in general, and it's usually literature written by clinicians, and I was a counselor then subsequently to those 5 years, too, doing clinical work with gifted kids and their families. So this is kind of what I'm basing this on, not only those 5 years of the discussion groups. But there's a whole bunch of literature that talks about sensitivities. Gifted kids, excuse me, do not have a corner on sensitivity, of course. But according to some clinicians and theorists, the cognitive ability, this great information processing ability, then there, it makes, in a way, a very hypersensitive response to the environment. And that means all environments, the senses, you know, smells and touch and sounds and visual stimuli, but also marital distress and the classroom environment and the teacher's teaching style and the kids' learning style mismatch, all of that sort of thing. That is what we call like an oversensitivity, a hypersensitivity, ultrasensitivity. There's a theorist, Dabrowski, who has been really embraced, had a lot of effect on the gifted education field, who talks about overexcitabilities, psychic overexcitabilities, sensual overexcitabilities, psychomotor overexcitabilities. There are some others I'm forgetting right now. But I really can embrace that idea. I have seen it in front of me. With all these kids that I've dealt with and their families, acorns don't fall far from the trees, so we've got families that are also then hypersensitively responding to, and here's what where I'm going with that, I think even normal developmental transitions, puberty, going to school, leaving home to go to college, having, you know, wondering about sexuality and sexual orientation, or, I mean, any number of developmental things that normally would cause a little bit of stress, even a little bit of stress, if not a lot, gifted kids may in fact have hypersensitive responses to feelings involved, fears, loss of what you're leaving behind as you go through developmental transitions, but also anxiety about the future. So the hypersensitivity then has an effect developmentally, perhaps. And then with all the life transitions, life events that happen, negative things, upending things, gifted kids aren't exempt from family constellation changing and disruptions and relocations and parental unemployment and parental illness and death in the family and having a sibling maybe with a disability that involves a lot of the family. Giftedness can do the same thing, by the way. But all of this sort of thing, these life events can be, they'll be thought about and felt about quite, they can be quite thought about quite intensely So, and that's what I've studied, by the way. I've studied life events and their impact on kids, et cetera. I've done longitudinals where I've watched that and watched kids, followed kids for 4 years after high school who are kind of at risk for poor outcomes, underachievers, for instance, or kids that were depressed and suicidal, kids that were in severe conflict with their families for one reason or another, just kind of following them. And then those kids and then those that just watching life events. That's the kind of thing I'm fascinated by. What is the subjective experience of being traumatized when you're gifted? What is the subjective experience of being gifted and gay during the developmental years? I've studied that. What is the subjective experience of being a bully victim? And what is the subjective experience of being a gifted bully? And what are the thoughts? What about the violent thoughts? I've studied, that's been part of some work that I've done. And yes, indeed, I think it was something like 29% of the kids in eighth grade who didn't know whether they'd been bullied or not, but they had violent thoughts. And because we asked about that, and we found out that 67% of gifted eighth graders had experienced at least one of 13 kinds of bullying in the K-8 years, and that even a single incident back in kindergarten was remembered with horror, with a scarring kind of thing. So there's that hypersensitivity impact again.
So let me just summarize a couple of points here, and there might be others that you're wanting school counselors in training to recognize that there might be in some ways a kind of premature anxiety for these students.
I would even call it existential concerns at very young ages. I know that happens. I've seen it in front of me clinically, where kids are really wrestling with the ultimate aloneness or,
So the questions that we might typically expect older...
If at all. Yes.
Older clients to struggle with, they might expect to see this in that population.
At that age, when they aren't developed socially and emotionally, they're not equipped to handle that. And we call that asynchronous development. Meaning that you've got this, cognitive development that's way ahead, but not social development and not emotional development.
So the opportunity to worry about things you're not prepared to figure out yet.
Yeah, and in that regard, we've got gifted kids who may be parentified because they are so bright. They are playing the parent role in the family. They have far too much responsibility for family decisions. In some cases, they may be running the house because the parents are not there in one way or another, because of course gifted kids can happen at any level of society and at any context, and this parentification is a concern. I've seen it, and those kids, they are the bottom line, and that's anxiety producing in itself if you can't count on an adult close to you to be the bottom line in crisis.
So some anxieties ahead of when we might expect them developmentally. And then the second piece that you talked about was really this kind of hypersensitivity mm-hmm. to the normal kinds of things that happen in our lives. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if you have found social isolation as an issue.
Yes. Marika Gross is an Australian researcher, highly respected in the field, and she has studied friendship, and especially among the profoundly gifted. And maybe I should say here, if you think about the bell curve, and you think about that upper end of the bell curve, it kind of where it starts going into the tail is usually where the cutoff is, if they're going to use a cutoff score of ability. That's usually where giftedness begins. And then you can go out another 30 IQ points or more, which is about as far from the beginning of giftedness to this end of the range as the beginning of giftedness is from average. That's a tremendous amount of differentness, because the kids at the beginning of giftedness, two standard deviations above the mean, if you go down on the bell curve to the other end, two standard deviations down, those kids are having a hard time functioning in the classroom, in the regular classroom. And I would argue that similarly, these kids increasingly so as you go up on that long tail of the bell curve. So that is the thing that we have to think about when we think about friendships, because there are many kids in some schools where there may not be any intellectual peers, and there may not be any intellectual peers in the state for some kids, obviously, who are way up into that profound area, profound giftedness. But regardless, they have to manage that social interaction. Some people can do it well, even if they're highly gifted, but they're probably going to be having to make some pretty significant adjustments. Some can manage it, some don't manage it so well. So according to America Gross, you've got kids that are moving into what they want in a friendship, into that stage very early in their lives. Maybe at 6 to 8, they may be where some other kids, as far as what they'd like in a friendship, what they need in a friendship, that would be for normally for kids much older. And that makes this kind of, there's another dyssynchrony there that's going on, and sadness and potential isolation and distress and loneliness. We don't think about that too much. But that's, if the school counselor can understand that and be empathetic and open to this possibility, instead of maybe assuming that the kids, my goodness, with all they've got going for them, they don't really have any, what should we be worried about them for? Well, it takes until one of them commits suicide or drops out of school or does something else that's pretty dramatic. That's when we pay attention, and we then consider it kind of an aberration, but we don't know what's going on. They don't ask for help very much.
Yeah, and what strikes me as you talk about it is that there are sort of several hurdles to get past. One is that there are these internal experiences that we might not notice, but even when we educate ourselves and know that there's this hypersensitivity, there are these anxieties, there's isolation, even when we know that, there is this overlay of expecting, but if you're that smart, things are good for you.
And figure it out.
Right.
Even if you're depressed. And they won't tell about that because they have that message. They've internalized that message that they should be able to figure it out.
And if I'm feeling overwhelmed with all the things I have to attend to,
right,
why should I be attending to this particular group that seems advantaged?
Yes. One thing I found out in this study of life events, we asked these graduates after the 10 years of following them, as they graduated, what were their biggest hurdles? What were the biggest challenges of the school years? And many of them had, I think there were maybe 70 kids that followed through there quite a while. I think there were something like 96 deaths in the extended family that they had experienced. So, and there were major things that had happened. But in spite with all of that, what they listed as the most challenging were was overcommitment. They were in a school where there was a lot of competition and a lot of high expectations. I would they would articulate that. And others would say that the worst week of their life, regardless of what had happened in their family or whatever, was when they had 5 AP tests in 1 week. And many of them did a tremendous amount of service stuff out in the community and were involved in a lot of extracurriculars because, as the principal who cooperated with me on that study said to me, she said, I think there's such pressure these days for them to distinguish themselves from the pack. And if they're surrounded by people who are that are equally capable, then they are really pushing themselves in order to compete for Ivy League colleges, you know, that sort of thing. And she was very concerned about that, and that came out in the study when we started analyzing the data. Overcommitment and stress from expectations from other people and themselves, that was really, that was the biggest thing.
So clearly what you are trying to let people know is this is a population that merits some attention, mm-hmm, and that really deserves services. So as we think about...
They deserve differential counseling approaches.
That's what I want us to talk about next. When, as a counselor educator, I'm curious what you think training programs need to be offering counselors in training so that they can better work with this population.
Okay, I guess I can think of about three things. Number one, I'm a big group proponent, and I think that if you want to talk about risk in schools, I'd say think about giftedness as a risk factor. That's one way to think about it, and to make sure that then in your training, you are not leaving those kids out when you want to think about prevention-oriented developmental groups. And I really believe that gifted kids deserve their own groups, and I would highly recommend that the gifted kids not be put in heterogeneous groups according to ability. They should be homogeneous according to age, because they need to learn from each other, no matter how physically developed or not, or socially developed or not, they are. But when they are put in these homogeneous groups according to ability, they will trust. They really believe that no one can understand their weird head. I heard that over and over and over again. And when they are put into a group that can establish trust, they say, I had no idea that anybody had thoughts like that, or was worried about that, or felt this. And that was huge to me. So that truth, or whatever you want to say, that reality, if that can be instilled
a sense of community.
Yes.
And I'm really struck by this idea of giftedness being a risk factor. And how often do you think that's actually happening, that people think of it in those terms?
Extremely rare. It's only, as I say, when something bad happens and then they say, oh, my goodness, what a surprise. He had everything going for him, or she had everything going for them, for her. I would also say that it's very important to think, just as we try to raise awareness about dealing with sexual orientation, race, gender, age, whatever, that we think about counselor attitudes about gifted kids, or maybe specifically about underachievers, or maybe specifically about high achievers, because people have attitudes about these kids. And I'm concerned always, including with my students when I work with them, that they're going to be too much in awe of the intellectual adeptness that they have in front of them, and then not be able to do counseling, because those gifted kids don't believe that anybody can understand them. And as soon as somebody indicates that they're intimidated or uncomfortable, or this is even worse in my opinion, needing to put them in their place. I've studied people that had that experience. They were brilliant, they were beautiful, they were talented. They were achieving at certain points. I did study a trauma survivor where this was the case. And she said she repeatedly ran into people who felt that she needed to learn how to fail. She needed to learn disappointment. She needed to learn about rejection. And they would actually speak in those terms. And what she needed desperately, because she was suicidal and had an eating disorder and had been traumatized and nobody knew about it, she was constantly getting those messages. So what should counselors in training think about? They should self-reflect and decide if they are comfortable. Are they going to be, working with gifted kids? Can they be poised, just as with any other special population? And can they really receive and be open to the inner world of that kid and not be just preoccupied with the academics, with their early career development, or whatever that might make immediate sense, but that they really need to be just as exploratory with those kids about needs and concerns as with anybody else. That's what those gifted kids aren't getting.
So the counselor's reaction to that.
Mm-hmm. To really self-reflect before you even get there. What I mentioned before about what do they feel about underachievement? Well, I have a lot of high achievers in my counseling program, and frequently, when we're kind of discussing this, somebody will say, after I do a presentation and I have a certain way that I try to get this across, they'll say, I realize that because I'm an achiever, I really realize I have no sense and no compassion for, but also no sense about underachievers. They're almost like an impossible, just a lack of ability to really connect. And then I've had former underachievers in my master's program, and they'll say, that they have feelings about high achievers, that fit the stereotype and all of that sort of thing. So I think that's a big thing, And then also to realize that when you're talking to kids, gifted kids, you really do have to think in terms of an adult to an adult type of reaction, of interaction, because of their intellectual ability. But at the same time, and this is a key thing for me, using a developmental framework, approaching every kid like, what am I hearing here? Is there something about identity? I mean, maybe even the giftedness, which some people say is a struggle. How do you incorporate your ability into your identity? That can be very difficult for some people. It can be the whole identity, but it can also be difficult to embrace that. But it could also be, are we talking about peer relationships? Are we talking about finding direction? Are we finding about autonomy? Are we seeing that in us, in the kids that are in front of us? That'll help us, I think, to then see them as human and forgetting about the stereotypes. You don't have to talk about giftedness. If you want to, you can. You can do some psychoeducational stuff about the hypersensitivity. Sometimes that's an aha to the kids. They say, oh, I make sense, you know, which can be a key thing. But the main thing is just simply to be there in the same way that you would be with anybody else, but keeping in mind that everything that I've been talking about here, you know, that has to be in your mind. Be careful. Don't just think that they got it made. And don't just think that they're exempt from life difficulties, and don't forget they're human. And growing up and scared and concerned and struggling and not leaning easily on other people. I've run into that many times in my own research, where they just don't lean on other people.
As you talk about this, it makes me curious about the school counselor's potential role with the parents.
Well, that's a pretty important piece. The stereotypical parent of gifted kids might be, you know, the stereotype might be pushy, over, you know, micromanaging, helicopter parent. And I would say that counselors do have to deal with them. And sometimes they get a little, that can be difficult. Administrators the same way. They have to, they may have difficulty with those parents. What I think is important to understand is that the parents probably have some of these characteristics that I've been talking about, and that many times parents are really anxious. They have concerns about this tremendous responsibility that they have. And when I talk to parents, and I do trainings for them too sometimes, is to try to take that burden off their shoulders and help them to model for their kids. And counselors can actually help parents do this, to model making mistakes and being imperfect and playing, having a sense of play and not making the future everything. In counseling, we learned about being in the moment. And I think this is a population we need to help. We need to teach them. We need to help them be in the moment. We can do that as counselors, to be in the moment. We can also help parents then allow their kids to be in the moment, and not that every stitch of their lives, that achievement is the only concern, and that the future is the main concern. So to be in the moment, that's something that the counselor can contribute.
Mm-hmm. You're making a variety of recommendations, and I wonder if programs were to think about an initial step or two that they might take to begin to incorporate this into their curriculum a little more, or to enhance it in some way, what would your recommendations be?
Well, what I would like to accomplish from myself in the next couple of years, to be honest, there really aren't that many people working in this area. I'm just leaving in about another month. I'll be no longer the chair of the Counseling and Guidance Division of the National Association for Gifted Children. And we kind of know where the people are that are counselors of gifted out there. Who are the clinicians who are that are experts? They aren't all writing, unfortunately, and they aren't all doing research, but we kind of keep our thumb on the pulse there. What I'm hoping to do is, I just did this for Ohio, as a matter of fact, to create a module for a grant that would help train counselors, school counselors, and that's going to be done now. It was done, according to their to the plan, to the framework that they were working under. I would like to create something generic, but very specific too, that could be put into the hands of counselor education programs, especially if they don't have access to somebody that can speak about this inner world part. And the inner world, in addition to the early career development and things like that. That would be something I hope to accomplish. And the fact that KCREP now, when they're redoing the standards, I'm expecting by 2008 that there will be reference, there already is in the drafts, reference to ability and extreme ability as being one of the dimensions that we need to be knowledgeable about as, you know, as trainees, and also I guess mostly it's the knowledge and I think that's the dispositions, foundational aspects, that I think that will be in there. So it will be up to programs to figure out how to incorporate this information into their training programs. I'm hoping to be able to contribute to that, obviously, and the book that Sal Mandaglione and I did, one of our hopes is that this book can be helpful. It's called Models of Counseling, Gifted Kids in General, but it's 8 clinicians that actually work with gifted kids who are presenting their perception of giftedness, their perception of personality, their perception of counseling, and so it's really a good textbook that could be a nice supplement in a course. I don't know where this would fit, but depending on where they're going to attend to this, that would be very user-friendly reading for a future clinician. And the so anyway, that's one thing. And in a year, there's going to be a book, another version of my Talk with Teens books. The one that's coming out this year is for at-risk kids in general, or just for development of middle school kids and above. The one that's coming out in a year will be geared to gifted kids. So there's going to be a book that could be used for group work with the gifted kids. I contend that any group work, any, you know, if you put them together according to intellectual ability, you can use any developmental work with them, and it will be appropriate because they don't have opportunity to talk about development with each other or with anybody most of the time. Okay, I think that would be probably all I would say about that. We need information, we need materials. This is urgent, in my opinion. It's been a long time in coming. And in the 20 years I've been involved in the gifted education, in the counseling part of gifted education, I've seen a lot of growth in interest. And, you know, even at the national meetings now, we have some of the highest attendance among all 14 divisions or whatever we have there, which indicates something, that people are coming. The lines are long after we speak when people are coming up with situations that they would like help with. And there really aren't enough counselors out there in general, in practice, even in communities that have expertise in this area.
And then I guess I would add that on your website is a list of your books. So for listeners who are interested in doing a little more reading on what you've written, they could find references there.
And you can go in through Purdue. And I'm in the Department of Educational Studies, and the easiest way, if anybody forgets, it's EDST for Ed Studies, EDST, so www.edst.purdue.edu, and then just follow the links, and they can find me.
It's great. It's been so nice to talk to you about this. Thank you very much for doing the interview.
My pleasure. It's always nice to talk about, about important work.
Yes. Thank you, Jean.
You've just heard an interview of Dr. Jean Peterson from Purdue University about working with the gifted child, done by contributing editor Nona Wilson. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselaraudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4242. counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.